You know, there's a lot that Americans agree on, and there's a lot that Americans disagree on. One of the things we agree on, regardless of what party affiliation people have, is that the level of incivility of discourse has gone to a new low. Some people, and this is where we differ, some people applaud how low civil discourse is going, while others commiserate over it. I think that we can probably pretty much agree that passions are growing regardless of what a person's position is. And so then the question becomes, well, how do we properly express our views and our passions as we engage others in conversation, particularly when it comes to religious matters? And to help us get a grasp of that, let me return to a conversation that I had previously with Dr. Richard Langer. All right, everyone. It is good, as I mentioned, to have you with us. Thank you so much for holding on as I got us connected with our guest, yours and mine, Dr. Richard Langer. And I tell you what, he is really meeting us at a time, a critical time in our nation's history, a critical juncture within the timeline of history, period. We have so much going on. It seems like rhetoric is being heated up, and Dr. Langer is going to talk with us about rhetoric. You all know you often hear me say that it's so important that we move beyond the rhetoric to the reality of the situation. But I like the way he defines rhetoric in his book, Winsome Persuasion. And that's what this is about. Dr. Langer is joining us today to share with us how those of us who purport to be followers of Christ can engage society in more meaningful ways, in more appealing ways. Dr. Langer, it's so good to have you with us. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, Carl. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a privilege to be able to join you guys and your audience to be able to talk about such a kind of critical issue in the time that we find ourselves in.
It is critical. And I mean, this book, Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in a Post-Christian World, answers so many questions and in the process gives so much awesome guidance. Doctor, I want you, if you would, to please first share with us, if we could just get a chance to get to know Richard Langer a little bit better. What was life like for you coming up as a child? And when I say a child, not only as a 10-year-old, but also as a 15-year-old, as an 18-year-old, what was life like? And just in general terms, but as you talk with us about what life was like, generally speaking, for Richard Langer, if you would also include in that a discussion of how dialogue, how interactions were going at that time.
Yeah, well, so I grew up, kind of came of age in the 1960s and 1970s. I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, and it's sort of the Rocky Mountain version of Berkeley or somewhere like that. You know, it's sort of it was a controversial community. We had the University of Colorado there. There was a lot of, the hippie movement was big. I remember when they burned down Old Main on campus. So, you know, it's funny. We're in a very volatile time with rhetoric now, but the bottom line was we've done this before. And the 1960s certainly was that kind of a time. So for me, I was growing up at that time and kind of watching all of that and was, you know, sort of intrigued as a grade schooler or junior higher in the 60s and 70s, kind of looking at what was going on. I came to Christ when I was in high school, but I didn't really think much about the political implications or the public implications, but it was a very personal and private decision for me at that time, I think. And I think over the course of the years, I realized that that decision for Christ was a little bigger in its implications than I first thought. It's certainly no less personal and spiritual, but it also has some real public, consequences and entailments, too. So, you know, that's been a thing that I've become increasingly aware of, I think, over the course of the years.
You know, you mentioned that what we're experiencing now with regards to public discourse is not anything new. And of course, in the 60s, like I said, we had the hippie movement. We had the free love thing going on, especially people thinking about Woodstock. Yeah. We had Vietnam going on. With all of the various issues that people were debating, When it comes to sameness, you know, this, what we're experiencing now is nothing new. Was the vitriol, did we have a presence of vitriol then that we have now? Or did it seem like people were willing to talk with each other a little bit more than now?
Yeah, you know, it's hard when I see things now through adult eyes and I saw things then as more of a kid. It does seem to me like the vitriol has gotten worse. The issues were bigger, but the rhetoric is worse now. You know, the issues were bigger back in the 60s in many ways, I think. But the rhetoric and the tone of the discussion has become really kind of toxic lately. Even in the last couple of years, it seems to have gotten substantially worse.
And
I'm very concerned about that. And I'm worried that we end up kind of talking past each other instead of talking to each other.
And I think, and this is one of the reasons that I am so appreciative of you for having written the book, Winsome Persuasion. It seems that, you know, you mentioned that when you initially yielded your life to Christ, submitted to Christ, one of the things that may not have been at the forefront of your thinking was the public consequences of that decision. And I think that so often, even when Christians today want to engage in public discourse about the issues that confront us, so often Christians add as much to the vitriol as anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of hard to hear that sometimes for me when I try to picture Jesus saying some of the things I hear Christians saying, and it's hard for me to do that. The idea that we would not only love our neighbors but do good to those who persecute us is oftentimes completely incompatible with the sort of rhetorical tone that we seem to have adopted.
I agree. And so to that end, you have provided this book with a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of insight. And one of the things that you point out is that it's important for us to recognize early in the game that we are dealing with a situation wherein there is a public and there is a counterpublic. Would you explain that to us?
Yeah. So one of the things I think that is generally true in kind of human events, so to speak, is that people end up with very different opinions about, you know, broad social issues like this. And someone ends up holding the power and control, and somebody ends up not. And those who are actually holding the power and control become what you might call the public, the broad prevailing power structures. And particularly when you have a strong public, these are the people who are making the social policy and things like that. But others will look at what they are doing and say, but that isn't right. There's something wrong with what's going on. And that could be classic examples of counterpublics. There are things like the abolition movement by William Wilberforce in the late 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s. I think of Dr. Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. When you're looking at the prevailing culture and saying something is wrong, let me and those who are like-minded with me somehow make our voice be heard. That's when you become a counter-public. It isn't a thing you usually do by yourself, but rather you do it as an alternative group of people who are saying, wait, we have a different vision for how things ought to work in our society, and we want to articulate that vision, and we want to call others to rally around, and ultimately we would like to change what the public is. So that's kind of the idea of a counterpublic, and I think for us Christians, we like the idea better when we think that we are like the phrase from the 80s, the moral majority. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is we might have been the moral majority in 1980, but I don't think that's true in 2017. I think we're the moral minority, and interestingly enough, oftentimes the immoral minority, because the views that we may have about certain sexual issues or other things like that are not in favor, and in fact, they're often considered immoral. That would ever judge any sexual behavior that anyone did as being morally wrong is the thing that's sort of viewed as reprehensible by people. So we find ourselves in this weird position of being a counter-public. We are just not the prevailing majority view anymore, and we need to begin to live and operate that way.
And you mentioned that, and I'll tell you something, Dr. Langer, that I find so interesting, is that as I read what you have shared with us about the counter public. It seems like it becomes so important for us to realize that the counter public in other scenarios are the majority. In other words, you have so many people from amongst the white community. We know that in America, the white community is the majority ethnicity, the majority race. But within the white community, you have people who will say, hey, you know what? This Christian group who says, when it comes to this issue, we disagree with what many in our country are saying. And we have something else that we'd like to say about that same issue. And they may be in the minority on that issue, even though they may still be a member of the majority race in the same country.
Yes. And so this is one of those interesting things about a counterpublic. It kind of organizes around issues or concerns and things like race or ethnicity or gender or a bunch of other things overlaps with a public or a counterpublic in really different ways on different topics. So in some places you might find yourself, you know, absolutely in line with a kind of the majority public perception. In other cases, you may find yourself completely out of touch with that. And you're right. It really depends upon the issue. And oftentimes, I would point out, even within the church, there may be people sitting beside you in the pew who are on the opposite side of an issue that you hold, you know, to be very mm-hmm. dear to you and very much born out of your Christian convictions. But another person may see it differently. And that person might actually be sitting there beside you in the pew, be a member of your same gender or race or whatever other group you want to identify with. The counterpublic and public issue is the thing that really does, you know, vary, and you do find yourselves on either side of those kind of issues.
And, you know, I'm curious about the psychological impact and how that psychological impact helps an individual determine how they're going to approach a particular issue. I'm thinking, for example, about, let's say, within America, of course, we have the black race, which is not the majority race. The black race is a minority race at all times. And so when that black race also takes a position or assumes, you have people within the black race who assume the position of the counter public. Now it's almost as though you have a minority within a minority. But so many black people are accustomed to being seen as a member of the minority group and treated as such, that is almost, I'm wondering if there's an adjustment that they need to make, as much of an adjustment in dealing with issues that go against the grain as compared to the adjustment that members of the white community who are a member, who now become part of a counterpublic, would have to make, since that they're really not accustomed to seeing themselves as members of a minority group.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I think you're right. For sort of white Christian America has, for on so many issues for so long, I think, you know, faithful Christians have been able to assume that there'd be sort of this broad consensus, and they've let minority groups kind of say, oh, well, minority groups and minority groups may have their own views, but I don't think people feel threatened or they don't feel like they're on the outside looking in. I think for Christians in the last maybe 10 to 15 years, that's begun to change. And I think you're right that for many people, we're now looking at ourselves the way minorities have always had to look at themselves. And we don't like having to deal with that.
Yeah.
So it's not such a comfortable position. And it is an interesting point, too, for the black community. You know, at times there's particularly among the evangelical black community, you may find yourself at odds with other members that you've usually been aligned with other public groups that you've been aligned with on other issues, because of you know, the particular issue that you're dealing with. You're saying, well, wait a minute, you may have an agenda that looks really good to me on 80% of the stuff, but suddenly you're going off on this issue where I really disagree with you. So it sometimes you feel like you need a roadmap with a lot of labels on it to figure out
yes,
where are we on these issues. I thought
so
I knew
true.
Who was on my side and who wasn't. Like, well, it really depends.
And it can get heated. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Langer really shares with us. He really breaks down for us what happens with regards to interactions, helping us see it as it really is, but also helping us see it as it should and can be. We're going to share some more of those insights with you because we really want you to be empowered to the point where you decide, hey, you know what? I don't like the way the dialogue has been going over the past 20 years, but I'm still not ready to check out either. So somebody, can you give me some guidance on how to remain engaged, but in a better way than I've been seeing others engage up to this point? Dr. Langer has some great insights to share with you and with me. Stay with us. We'll be right back.